my name's Roy, and I'm an addict. And, you know, I will not be afraid. I have nothing to fear, and I have nothing to fear. And, you know, to be here tonight with all you people, this is such an honor, and for allowing me into your lives and you guys being a part of my lives, it's like I words can't describe how cool it is just to be here with you all tonight. And I love NA, and you know, all the chances I've got in my life through NA, it's like what I do for service today, I really enjoy, and man, I owe big time. And I can never give it back. If I had a million years lifespan, I could never give it all back, what I've been given by this program and by the people here. You've given me an understanding of God. I have a higher power in my life today, and that came from you people, from the fellowship, from the love. And that's what's always kept me coming back, is the love and acceptance here that was just, you know, given freely. And it is so cool. Now, you know, I started out in a house that was insane. My father was a doctor. He was a drug addict. The access to drugs, he had a clinic and a pharmacy. The pharmacist was a drug addict. Both of them died from their addictions. But there were, you know, unlimited supply of drugs. He was also had an FFL license. He dealt in firearms until that was pulled from him. So the drugs, the insanity, he was an amphetamine user, a really nasty son of a bitch. And he did a good job terrorizing me, filling me with fear and mistrust for people. And at 15, he gave me my first drugs. Gave me, you know, Benzedrine for some reason, staying up for a test or something like that. And the first time I took that drug, I felt like this was it, man. This was the answer to my life. I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel like I needed anybody anymore. I was like, I felt like a whole person. And that was the biggest goddamn lie, because that drugs put me in a cage of fear and loneliness all my life. That as it progressed, the bars of that cage got thicker and thicker, and you know, I went on for the progression. I was raised in the San Francisco area back in the mid-60s. Drugs were kind of replaced everything else. People, instead of, you know, going out and getting six packs of beer, they got, you know, the psychedelics and all that stuff, and everybody was doing that. But there was something different about me than a lot of the people I hung with, because that's all I wanted to do. I lost interest in, you know, school, dropped out of high school. Here I was, you know, a guy with two highly educated parents, a doctor, and my mother was a physical therapist. And here I am, I drop out of high school, and nobody says nothing to me. You know, I just didn't go back one year. It was like, you know, they never said nothing. So, you know, I just kept going thinking that... you know, this was the way to live, and get involved with people who were you know, in the drug world, dealing drugs, and I thought this is what I wanted to do. Now, finally, I guess 19, my mother had me committed to a mental hospital. Because I was pretty much fried up from the drugs, and she used the courts. And in those days, in the 60s, you could get put into a mental hospital and pretty much get lost in there, and, you know, and get written off and be in custodial care, because they didn't have a patient's bill of rights or any of that kind of stuff back then. It was, you know. So in this place, what they were doing with drug addicts, because you were having the first, you know, big influx of all us burnouts coming and, you know, needing help. And they were using electric shock treatments as an experimental therapy to see if they could cure addiction. And, you know, when I realized what was going on and going into this place, because I was told, like, well, you're going to talk to a therapist. And two big burly guys grabbed me, and, you know, I ended up in a straitjacket, shackled to a bed. And when I calmed down some and started getting a little bit of, you know, eating regular and whatnot, and my calming down, I saw people who had had batteries, 70, 80 of these electric shock treatments, who they had vegetabilized. You know, young people, you know, 19, 20, and they're 20 now, and they were vegetables, and they were shipping them off to custodial care in the state facilities. So I thought, man, you know, you got to gut with the program to stop fighting these people and get out of here. Otherwise, you're never going to get out. And I did that. But in there was a guy who had started telling me about the AA program. And one thing, I'll mention AA in my talk, because there was no NA back then, not much of any. And I have a real resentment, and you'll find out why, against AA. So it's something I try to do to bring out that there were a lot of good-hearted people in AA who helped us in the beginning, and to this day still do. And I don't want to forget, because I don't want to resent AA. I don't want to resent anybody today. So you hear me mention AA, you know, this guy was telling me about the program and that it could help me with my problem. And, you know, I asked them all, you know, if this thing's so great, how did you end up in here? And he told me something about a slip, and I thought, you know, I thought like a woman's slip, or what, you know, what's this dude talking about, you know? So, but anyway, it sounded pretty cool. So I got out of there, started using it again, and started having grand mal convulsions. And I was to have them for 4.5 years. And I don't know if they were from the electric shock treatments or the drugs or whatever, but I thought, you know, this isn't good. So I contacted a friend of my family's who was a longtime AA guy. And this guy, Bob L., and he finally died with almost 60 years clean. And he was a big-time jazz musician. Now, I don't know much about music or anything, but he was a jazz pianist. He had a, because at the time I was living in Palm Springs, California, he had his art gallery on the main drag in Palm Springs, and had his piano and all, and he knew everybody. I mean, he knew guys like Red Skelton, Lucille Ball. I mean, he knew everybody. And he took me to meetings, and there was some degree of acceptance, I think probably because I was with him, but anyway, I started going to meetings and staying clean. I then moved back east because there were some job opportunities with my family. I owned an elevator contracting business, so I went back to get into that trade. And when I got back to Philadelphia, started looking up AA meetings, and the people, I definitely got closed doors. They did not want, you know, this burnout speed freak coming to their meetings. And I was told in no uncertain terms, we can't help you. Mm-hmm. Until one night, a woman followed me out of the meeting and told me and said, look, there's this group of guys down in Kensington, which is a kind of rough area of Philadelphia. And you can go, you know, they'll be able to help you. So I was contacted. I gave her my phone number. I was contacted by a guy, Dick F. And he took me to my first meeting there. And they let me hang out there and go to their meetings, and I got involved in the club and the AA fellowship. The only thing about all that was it gave me a very distorted view of the program, because their view of the program was you can do anything you want, just don't drink. And by their idea of, you know, of doing anything you want, this was a club that was filled with burglars, filled with the strong arm guys for the different, like the Teamsters Union and the roofers up there, There were guys from this group that they gave the moniker the Irish Mafia, which was a group of Irish guys from Kensington who were professional burglars, car thieves, and whatnot. And it was like, you know, just don't drink. You be a better burglar, don't drink, you'll be a better burglar. So I got this view that, you know, I got this the education I got was, you know, I can do anything I want, just don't pick up. Well, we all know, man, it don't work that way. You got to change your life and use those steps and integrate these steps into our lives. Otherwise, you know, it ain't going to be too cool. So, you know, I went there, and what happened was people started hearing, AA people started hearing, there was this, you know, young drug addict clean at this young men's club. So these were parents of people who were, you know, getting strung out on drugs. So people would come and say, hey, how about talk to my son, talk to my daughter, they're getting all screwed up, you know, see if you can help them. So I started to get what I considered real 12-step work, because I was now talking with addicts, you know, and it was cool. We got a little group of us together, and we would go to the young men's club, and then they got the idea, no more addicts at our meetings. We don't want it. They had a group conscious meeting, and it was funny because the guy who led this movement to ban us, I called him Horseshit Bill, because every other word out of this guy's mouth was like horseshit, you know, never ever got horseshit. So, and the irony of it all is years later I heard from a member of the Young Men's Club that old Horseshit Bill died of, you know, an overdose of pills. So that might have prompted his, you know, he don't want any drug addicts in coming to the meetings, because we were like a mirror of, hey man, you're living a lie. So at that point, you know, we tried to hold meetings in people's kitchens, and we used the big book, but it was really, you know, the enthusiasm was just gone. It felt like, I remember when they did that, there was a guy, you know, he was clean a while, and he started crying when he heard the, you know, they told us you can't come in here anymore. That was like a really devastating blow, because it was about, you know, love and a higher power and, you know, helping others. And they shut the door to us. And it was really, I mean, it broke my heart. And it really pissed me off. So that's a resentment I have to this day that requires constant work on my part. But there were, you know, once again, there were a lot of good-hearted, open-minded people in AA to help us. So I thought, you know, I'm going to hell with this East Coast shit. So I went back west and looking, seeing if I could find a job out there in Palm Springs. And, you know, I talked to Bob L. and was running in his ear down about, you know, what a bunch of pricks the people in AA were back east and, you know, and so forth. And he said, and it just happened that weekend, they were holding a convention in Palm Springs, an AA convention, and he said, look, there's going to be some big shots from this Narcotics Anonymous for you to talk to. So, yeah, Narcotics Anonymous, see? Because, like I said, Bob knew everybody. I mean, that weekend I met, besides meeting Jimmy Kay, and I met the guy who was one of the founders of Gamblers Anonymous, and it was kind of cool. But I met Jim Kay, and he had these white books, and we had a meeting, and he was like really fired up about NA, you know, like now there was something for us, for addicts, something that would work, something that we could call our own. And he gave me those little white books, and he said, you know, get them printed up and go start meetings. And we held our first, the first meeting that I participated in. We had a little meeting, there were like four or five of us, and I was just, because Jimmy Kay had this strength and serenity and this positive about Narcotics Anonymous, so it just infected me. And on the plane ride back, you know, I was like really fired up. Well, when I got back to Philadelphia, and started going to places to see about getting a meeting. I tried churches, tried the Y, tried youth centers, and people were like, you know, drug addicts, junkies, dope fiends, you know, get to the other side of the street, man. We don't want to, you know, we don't want you around here. And a lot of resistance. We couldn't get a meeting started anywhere. And one place I went to in over New Jersey, in Camden County, was a youth center, and the guy had some connection to law enforcement. And he started yelling at me, telling me, oh, you try to do that, I'm going to get the state police on you because it's illegal for drug addicts to congregate and you can't do that kind of stuff. And it was like, man, what's going here? We want to do something with our lives, man. We want to stay clean. We want something good in our life. And it was like, nah, you can't do that. So there was a guy who was he had been a member of the Young Men's Club, an alcoholic, Dick F., and he was now working at Eagleville Hospital, which was a alcohol rehab, and he had just started taking in drug addicts. And he got me introduced an appointment with this Dr. Ottenberg and Dr. Ottenberg's wife, who were the head psychiatrists. They ran this place. So I met with them. Now, I had a lot of shit with me because at the Young Men's Club, besides, you know, you can do anything you want and just don't pick up a drink, it was like, therapy's bullshit, rehabs are bullshit, psychiatry's bullshit, psychology's bullshit. So I'm laying on this rap to this guy about, you know, well, we don't, you know, your stuff here, what you're doing is a bunch of crap. All we need is NA, and you let us in here, and we don't, you know. So I had a second, interview with him, and to talk to him. But you know something? The higher power touched this guy's heart. Because he opened his doors and said, yeah, you can hold a meeting here. And that was the first NA meeting on the East Coast. He let outsiders come in, let the patients, whatever drug addicts they had in the wards, come to the meetings. And that was the first NA meeting on the East Coast. And I think of it, man, you know, from that, we got this. Yeah. It's like, you know, man, you know, is it good or what? It's like really cool, and from there, you know, some people started going through Eagleville and started meetings, and you know, we started the first meeting in the city of Philadelphia. And I want to say that in that area there in Philadelphia, Springfield County, Camden County, and Bucks County, those first meetings, there was myself, these two guys, Danny and Mike S., brothers, and there was also a woman involved in all that. And a lot of times the women get kind of shunted off the parts they play in things, but Maureen M. played a part in those first one, two, three, four of the four meetings outside of Eagleville. A woman played a part in all that. And that's something that's, you know, not in any of the books or anything, but it's like, that's a fact. And you know, in those days, there was like the group that came from Eagleville and went through the rehab, and then there was us people from the street down in Philly. And one of the differences was the Eagleville people all did the hugging, and the people in Philly, us street people, was like, no hugging, man. You know, no hugging. Don't keep the hugging. And that's a big change. The Eagleville people won out, and I think it's to the better anyway, you know, because it's really cool. But that was the beginning, and we got our first meeting at a prison out in Chester County. Was the Chester County Jail. They let us in, and an interesting story was. That was the first meeting, and you have to bear with me because I'm sometimes I lose track. And so we had taken a guy in. There would be a group of us going in there to the meeting. So we had taken a guy, the AA guy, who was my sponsor, said to me, look, you know, you got to take this guy, pick him up, take him with you. And it was a new guy, see? And it was he was a little Irish guy, and he had one of them, you know, Popeye Doyle kind of hats on. And so we picked him up on a street corner, took him into the prison with us. Well, by the time he must have taken something when we picked him up, before we picked him up. By the time we got him into the prison, because they didn't have any background checks or anything like that, he's dancing around and carrying on. Well, he got us thrown out of the prison, see? It took us about 3 or 4 months, you know, for us to get back in there. Because we didn't, what did we know? There was no, time requirements or anything like that. It just kind of went and, we just went and did it, you know. And, but it was, it was good. And there was one other guy I wanted to bring up. The first man who was in recovery, and he had close to a year, who relapsed and died, and his name was Jimmy C. And I don't know, it's all right to use the last name. Jimmy Karinga was his name. We called him Jumpin' Jim because he had jumped out of a second-story window and in a meth panic and had pins in his ankle, and then didn't get the pins taken out and had gangrene and had the ankle, had the foot taken off. So this guy had been through some heavy shit, and he was. I remember a night, him talking me through an obsession on Kensington Avenue, and we all liked him. He got back into a relationship he was suggested not to get back into, drifted away from the meetings, picked up, and hung himself in a jail cell. Now, Jimmy, and I wish he was here today, but he's not. But that's the first man, at least on the East Coast, who, he relapsed, and he died. And this is a life and death illness we have, and it don't go away. You got it, you got it. But there's something you can do about it, and that is the Narcotics Anonymous program, being involved with the fellowship, being involved with working the steps, integrating those steps into your life. And anybody can get up and talk a good line. And, the message is meaningless unless you live it. And I can assure everybody here tonight, I live this program to the best of my ability each day. I love this program. I love doing service work. I wish I had I have Hep C and cirrhosis, and it's getting bad. I wish I had more stamina, but 3 days a week, I go into our county. I live in Bucks County, north of Philadelphia, and I do 12-step work. I run with another guy an NA step meeting. I take prisoners in the minimum security work release center. They've allowed me to take guys out to NA meetings, and I love doing that. One thing about service work for me is, it keeps me clean. And it keeps it real fresh in my mind when I walk into that jail and the bars and the nasty guards sometimes I think a lot of times the guards are nasty to me. What are you here for and all this? But man, the nastier you are, the more it helps me, because that helps me stay clean. It's like, man, I don't want any parts of that. Keep this, man. I'm clean. I ain't going to end up inside there. I follow this program. I ain't going to end up inside there. So, but what service work does for me, it keeps me connected to people. It keeps that self-centeredness and that fear I've had all my life. It tears that wall down and keeps it down. And I think that's really cool. I had all these things I wanted to say, and now it's like, damn, it's tough getting old. Son of a bitch, man. Today I have 14 years clean. And, And it's been a long road, and the self-centeredness, my fear, my mistrust, kept me, going out. And it never started out with like, yeah, screw this, I'm just going to go out and get high. I always got like, well, the NA people, yeah, that's all right, but that's not for me. I can figure this thing out myself. And I've been involved in just about every screwball cult from, eating brown rice and sprouts. I lived in a commune and up in Boston, and we ate watermelon and sprouts and practiced yoga, and I would always end up spiking up again, trying Buddhism, trying different Christian religious cults. It just never gave me what I needed to stay clean. NA does. A couple of things, like in the paperwork, it said, ghosts from the past. And I had a chuckle at that because one of the things is my grandmother used to let me crash at her house occasionally. So they had this room, and it was a fence, a pretty close patio. So I would go there to sleep, and I would stash my drugs. They had a place out back, and I would stash the drugs and stuff out back. So one day I was in there, and it was daytime, and I wanted to go out and bring the stuff and then get loaded. But I was afraid to walk out back. See, I thought, oh, all the neighbors will see me going back and forth. They know I'm a drug addict. And, I don't want anybody to know that, they'll be calling the cops on me. So I'm thinking, how can I get out to that shed? If I was invisible, I could get back out there. And then I saw, a blanket on the bed. See? And I thought, I put that blanket over my head, they ain't going to be able to tell who I am, and that'll be just like being invisible, see? So I put the blanket over my head, and I went out, and I went, now the drugs turned me into a simpleton, because I was like this all the time, see? So I'm going out there with a blanket over my head, walking to the back and coming back, so my sister gets a phone call. Going, there's some, the neighbor's calling, there's somebody in your backyard with a blanket over their head. Is that your brother again? Are you letting them come, are you letting them hang back to the house? It's a little early for Halloween, So when I heard that ghost of the past, I thought, that's what the drugs did to me. It turned me into a simpleton and a menace. The menace stuff isn't so funny, but the simpleton part, a lot of the stories are, there was a time, like I lived in a commune, they would let me crash there at this commune, outside of Philadelphia, and they were all like pretty good-hearted people. They made, silverware. They were all hippies, and they made silverware. They shared everything. They made silver jewelry, leather stuff, and all, and they would go around to different places and sell them. So I had met one of the guy's sisters in a rehab. So they let me go there, but, they didn't want me firing up with any drugs. So I would go there and stay to sleep. So I'm driving there one night, and all of a sudden, all these lights are on behind me. And it's the cops, right? They're after me. Oh, man. So I drive up this dirt road, because they lived way, it was in the woods, thought this, this long, just a dirt, unfinished road. And I'm there, and the lights are still behind me, so I get out of the car, start running. Now, the snow is about, it's about a foot high. And I'm running in the snow, and I thought, damn, man, they're going to be able to track me and follow me and all this stuff. They'll be able to see right where I went. So what did I do? I pulled off my boots, put the boots under my arm, and I'm running in the snow. And I thought, and there was a tree down, and the tree, and I died behind the tree, and I got snow all over me, and it's cold, man. And I'm there, and it's like, You know, and I guess the cold started to, like, sober me up some, see? And I'm laying there, and there's no lights, and there's quiet, and it's like, yo, Roy, you know, nobody's following you, man. You're going crazy again, you know? And it was like, that was what the drugs did to me. They made me into a simpleton, and that was my big fear, was becoming permanently insane like that, because I was always able to pull back a little bit. And, you know, to end up in custodial care somewhere, insane, was my big fear. Not so much dying, it was losing this permanently. Now, 14 years ago, I had stopped going to meetings, maybe 10 years before that, and had become obsessed with material, the acquisition of material things. And I was a contractor, fixed elevators, and I was a crook. I took advantage of people. I didn't do the work right. I assembled a crew of men who thought like I did. You just take the money and you screw people. And, you know, people got hurt behind what we did. But 14 years ago, all those material possessions, because I had picked up alcohol, started drinking, because I wasn't no juice head. I'm not like them effing people in AA. I can drink. And you know, and after the first night, the next 3 years was drunk every day. It was just like any other drug I used. No control over it, no nothing, and sick all the time. Blackouts, and it got bad. So all those material things, they're repossessing the cars out of the driveway, and I had all kinds of material stuff, and it's all gone, and the credit, and the people calling you up all hours of the night, harassing you for money, and I couldn't buy parts anymore for the fixing elevators. Everything was, it wasn't even COD anymore. The people just didn't want to see my face or hear me, you know, calling them to try to get parts. So my kingdom was crumbling, and I was sitting in the shop was in North Philly, bad neighborhood, and we had a machine shop there, and it became very clear to me. It was like it was all in front of me that I say it was all along. It was like, you know, I don't know how to live. I don't know how to live. And that's what the steps were about. And it became clear to me that I had to surrender, that addiction isn't something that goes away. You can't gain social acceptability and that makes you no longer an addict. That you're an addict, it's a disease. And at that point, you know, I thought, well, I can go to the corner and get myself a couple bundles and some works and kill myself that way and do it right then and there and OD. I can take the pistol out of the drawer and put that in my mouth, or I can surrender. Mm-hmm. And I surrendered. And I went to a rehab, 12-step rehab out in California, and I made a commitment to leave no stone unturned to recover. I wanted to get better. I wanted what I had seen, because periodically, I'd come back to meetings and I'd see people, they had 10 years, and then they'd have 20 years, and then they'd have, you know, 25 and 30. And it was like, you know, they weren't the same people. Something had happened in their lives. And it was like, you know, I saw clearly that that could be my life too, but I had to surrender. I had to make these steps part of my life and change my life. And this past 14 years has been the best time of my life. And I've gone through some stuff that's heavy duty. I have two kids who are in prison. They're heroin addicts, a son and a daughter. And they have not just the drug use, they've dove into the life of being drug gangsters. And they are violent, scary people. And that grieves my heart, because I remember when they were little. And I love them. even though I moved 6 years ago, so they don't know where I live, because, man, you know, I don't want them hurting me or my girlfriend or my youngest son. So, you know, I've gotten through all that with people in the fellowship helping me, with my higher power. And with that, and the heartaches that you go through, it's like, it's still okay. That's life on life's terms. And sometimes bad things happen in life, but you know, no matter what happens in life, it's, I got a happiness with me today that comes from being clean and from reaching out and helping others. And I used to be one of those people who, you know, would look at somebody who had like 10 years, 14 years, 20 years, and see them, you know, them being like real gung-ho about the program, and I'd be there like, yeah, you know, they should get a life, you know, what are they doing, you know, I'm doing that, you know, that's because they don't have a life, they're a bunch of losers. It's like, man, I'm glad this is my life. I don't want it to change. I love being active in the NA program. I love carrying the message, going to rehabs, doing the 12 step walk with the prisoners. There's nothing like it, man. There's nothing like it. And I don't know. That's what it was like in the beginning. It was hard getting the NA, getting some acceptance. And today when I go to a, you know, like a rectory or someplace, I was speaking in a meeting a few weeks ago, and this rectory was beautiful. It's a library and comfortable leather chairs and all. And I thought, man, this is a far cry from the places we used to get stuck with, you know, in the early 70s. This is really cool. I mean, NA, you know, we have some acceptance today, and it's real, you know, it's really come a long way. Now, like, people all over the world, damn, this is great, you know? It really is great. And I am so glad to be able to have been here tonight with you guys, and you guys allowing me to share, let me be a part of NA. I love you all, man. Thank you.
Thank you.